Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper.
A lot of stuff went on this week. I guess we changed presidents, sort of, right?
Technically, yeah. Did you watch his speech? Kamala's speech?
No.
It was so platitude-free. I mean, sorry. Yes, laden. It was chock full of platitudes. I guess, is it normal to end with, like, God bless America and God bless the troops? It seems like a weird thing to end on, the troops.
Yeah, I need a minute. It's not like I'm missing Trump. I'm definitely not. It's also not over from...
Right.
That phenomenon is not past yet. Right. But I'm not terribly looking forward to the Biden-Harris era in terms of, like, watching it. You know what I mean? I'm looking forward to it in terms of not having to think about politics as much.
Yeah, but, like, you can't fall into that now we brunch thing.
Well, I can.
I guess you can. But the danger, of course, with them is that, and a lot of people, I think, on the left are fearing this, even though most people on the left are glad Trump is gone. But I think there's a fear that now that he's gone, we're not going to pay attention. And of course, that happened a lot with Obama. He did some really crappy things. I don't know. You probably didn't. You probably paid attention to his droning and all his finance.
I actually wasn't on. I was on the drone. I was on the finance stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I got in trouble early for doing a whole thing about his inaction on Wall Street and you know, they're all the same. They're all the same to me. So I don't really care.
Right.
You know.
I mean, what do you think we could, like? He won't do the upward. He probably won't do those tax cuts, right? That Trump did, those super. Wealth transferring, upwards transfer of wealth.
I'd be shocked if a lot of political capital was expended on reversing things like that quickly, but we can get to all of that when we talk about it later, I guess. So, all right, so let's do what we always do and start with the four food groups. Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that weird? What do we got for Democrats suck this week?
So Democrats suck, no surprise. Dan, if we could call up that article in Common Dreams, please. But we have the Democrats punching left punching. I just want to point out that a vast majority, it was 20 plus something out of 30 of the races where candidates ran on Medicare for All, they won. Okay. They won. Then we have people like Donna Shalala who lost. And she's trying to, I mean, what's incredible is, like, I almost admire the gall of these centrists in after losing, Donna Shalala actually said that moderates won.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why she didn't win then.
Yeah, she pulled a McCaskill.
Yes, McCaskill also, great authority as a loser on how to win elections. And also, John Kasich, he really needs to shut up. He's done. Move out of the way. The Dems already gave you a speaking part at the DNC versus, like, AOC got 2 minutes or something. He stood at that crossroads. He should have been omitted at that point because that was such a bad ad. Do you remember when he's standing at the literal crossroads? It was on the nose. And now he had one job.
I kind of admire that, actually. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, same way I kind of admire the Donna Shalala thing. I mean, different. I guess this was it was so stupid. Like, in general, you don't want to show the exact thing you're mentioning.
Mm.
It's a bit much.
Mm-hmm.
He could have said we're standing at a crossroads without literally being at a crossroads.
Right, right.
It's too much. It's too on the nose. It's too over. You're hitting people over the head. But this guy is going on the news. Now, he had one job to do. Deliver his home state of Ohio to Biden. And he failed. So it's not just, to be fair, I don't like him politically. He passed one of the most draconian abortion bills, by the way, as governor of Ohio. It had it illegalized the most common second trimester form of termination. And it's safer than the alternative. So he put women's lives at risk, their health at risk. And he didn't grant any exceptions for rape or incest. He's just terrible. He's absolutely terrible. He's not, the dangerous thing about him is that he has a moderate disposition. He seems like a reasonable, nice guy, but his policies are awful. So he's like the opposite of Trump. He's the opposite of Trump in demeanor, which again makes people really, I mean, as long as you're not Trump, the Dems are fine with you. Bill Kristol is welcome to the scene. David Frum, you know, people who really urged the Dems to, or urged, they're not Dems, they're right wingers, and they were very much behind regime changing Iraq. And these people are embraced.
Look, all these people who were involved in the Russiagate stuff are going to be getting high, you know, important posts. And, you know, John Brennan is already making noise about how we have to invoke the 25th Amendment to prevent Trump from declassifying things. So he's back in the scene. And my argument the whole time about why it was difficult to vote for Biden is because he's going to bring back all the worst people, especially from the national security side.
Yeah. Oh, and then so they're punching left again, reading from Common Dreams. Democrats have been hoping for big wins on election night with the possibility of winning not only the presidency, but also the Senate and increasing their majority in the House. But while Biden has come out on top, the party's most optimistic outcome in the Senate would be a 50-50 split if they win both Georgia runoff seats, giving them a majority with the vote of Vice President Kamala Harris. And rather than gaining in the House, the Democrats lost several seats. In the wake of these disappointments, the right wing of the party immediately blamed its left wing for the poor showing, airing their grievances in a private conference call among House Democrats that was leaked to reporters. In a write-up about the call, the Washington Post, Rachel Bade and Erica Warner quoted and paraphrased 14 sources blaming those who, quote, endorse far-left positions, end quote, for Democrats' losses, counterbalanced by only 4 sources defending the left. All the progressive sources were named. Half of the establishment sources were either quoted anonymously or presented as unspecified moderates. And in addition to quoting a handful of participants on the call, Bade and Warner interviewed numerous moderates for the article, but only managed to interview 2 progressives. I'll end it with saying that James Clyburn said that Dems had to stop running on Medicare for All or defunding the police or socialized medicine. And it's also worth noting that he's taken more money from the pharmaceutical industry in the past decade than any other member of the House or Senate.
Well, look, in a way, this, the outcome that happened, it's almost like the ideal circumstance for the kind of embedded Democrats, because they can still complain about the progressive wing, and especially in places like Florida, they can say, "Oh, this Bernie cost us Florida."
The interesting thing, though, about Florida, and I think this undermines the idea that Bernie Sanders cost them the election or cost them that going Biden, is that they voted overwhelmingly for a $15 minimum wage initiative. It passed by 22 points, and it's agreeing to have a $15 minimum wage by 2026. It required 60% of the vote to pass, and it exceeded that. So it's a ballot initiative. So yeah, again, all these left-punching Dems, maybe you want to look at that.
But people are going to be perfectly fine with that. I mean, watch, there's going to be very little media pushback to any of that. So
right.
Nothing too surprising about that. The Republicans suck. I mean, I think the funnier aspect of the story is probably going to come after we get some photos from it. But Dan, could we look at the Million MAGA March? So this is kind of classic. There's probably going to be like 10 million Trump fans descending upon Washington. Not 10 million, but there's going to be a lot of them. And they're naming it things like Stop the Steal, because in the conservative side, this whole situation is not over. They're going to pursue all sorts of legal remedies to try to look into what they think is a lot of fraud. So that's fine. They're going to do lots of protests and all that sort of thing. But classically, they have not applied for permits for this thing that's happening over the weekend. Or what they have applied for is maybe not to scale. This is from the Washingtonian. The organization for the Freedom of Speech Rally, the only application that the Park Service has received, is from an entity called Cindy Chafian Women for America First. The organization listed on the application has promoted the March for Trump on its Facebook page. The application doesn't sound like it's for a huge event. It says organizers expect participants to display 50 signs or placards and plan to rally in Freedom Plaza, disperse, then rally again at the Supreme Court. So maybe they're making a statement. I guess Republicans don't feel like they need to ask the government.
Exactly, right. They're anti-government, right? I mean, except for Trump, but their libertarianism.
Right.
It's compatible with their anti-permitism.
Right. So maybe that's what it is. I mean, I expect all sorts of things to happen with this march. Maybe they'll arrive in the wrong city.
Right.
You know, like the Million MAGA March, like by accident ends up in Roanoke or something like that.
Aren't they afraid of sounding like the Million Man March?
No, no, marketing.
But they hate the Million Man March, right?
I mean, I don't know if they hate it. They
probably were not excited about it, did not attend
right, but
it.
I mean, you know, as a marketing phenomenon, it was successful.
Yeah, they're co-opting
so
it.
They're co-opting it, so yeah. Look, this has become like a religion for a lot of people, and, you know, we just have to hope that it doesn't turn into violence. And then, you know, it's been kind of amazing that there hasn't been anything along those lines yet, you know, for all the predictions about all the unrest and all the boarding up of all the windows. So far, people have been pretty chill about the whole thing. So, maybe,
why do you think that is?
Why do I think that is?
Yeah.
Because I think the story about the potential for disorder was always probably overblown. Was probably something that was run by a lot of news organizations without a lot of evidence to support it.
I mean, I think also it was a useful thing for Trump to, like, you ratchet it up. And then the legal stuff then the legal opposition to it doesn't seem as extreme. I don't know if we're going to get to this, but another Republican sucked big time is Mike Pompeo saying he would assure the peaceful transition to a second Trump term.
I didn't even hear about that.
Oh my God. Yeah, he really did. And then they were like, well, other countries, this is kind of coup-ish behavior. I mean, this is like a pretty non-democratic thing to do. And he's like, that's a stupid question. You know that.
President Trump continues to contest the results of last week's election after counts show Joe Biden won the Electoral College and the popular vote by more than 5 million ballots. On Tuesday, the Office of Management and Budget said it was proceeding with President Trump's budget request for next fiscal year, and Trump's top cabinet member, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, said he's preparing for a second Trump term. Pompeo was questioned by reporters at the State Department.
Is the State Department currently preparing to engage with the Biden transition team? And if not, at what point does a delay hamper a smooth transition or pose a risk to national security?
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready.
Secretary of State Pompeo was asked to compare the Trump administration's response to Biden's victory with overseas elections where defeated candidates cling to power.
This department frequently sends out statements encouraging free and fair elections abroad.
Yes.
And for the losers of those elections to accept the results, doesn't President Trump's refusal to concede discredit those efforts?
That's ridiculous. And you know it's ridiculous. And you asked it because it's ridiculous.
Well, Trump is going to leave office. It's over. There's going to be a lot of Sturm und Drang before we get there. But I don't expect any of it to be real or anybody to actually try to stay in power longer than they can, absent some kind of court ruling, which I don't expect at all.
Yeah, because they don't have, unlike Bush, they don't have very skilled attorneys either.
Well, that was the whole point on election night. You know, they're looking around for somebody to try to intervene, and who's their front person? It's Rudy Giuliani,
right.
Who's 5 million years old and looks like Nosferatu, and yeah, it's not going to happen. It's already been decided. Even Fox News has pretty much bailed on Trump. So
yeah, did you see the Laura Ingraham thing where she's like, Donald Trump, if he steps down, will be so powerful. His legacy will just be so powerful.
Like she was, Christ himself, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. She was like talking to him like a baby, she wasn't talking to him. She was talking to people in general, but she was about Trump, but it was very clear she was talking to Trump indirectly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird to see her doing that. I'm going to push back though, Matt, on something really important. I don't agree with you that Giuliani looks like Nosferatu. And I think that we compared Biden to Nosferatu, and that's a much better resemblance. So we got to think about what Giuliani looks like. And in fact, viewers and listeners, if we don't come up with this by the end of the episode, I would like viewers and listeners to contribute their ideas.
Yeah, I probably overused that comparison just because anybody who has an overbite probably looks like Nosferatu to me. But
yeah.
What do we got for isn't that terrible?
Okay, so Dan, if we could open up this article. I mean, the headline kind of says it all, but reading from Business Insider, a mayor in Peru was accused of lying in a coffin and pretending to be dead to avoid being caught disobeying lockdown orders.
That's a good one.
It's a good one, right? Police in Peru say a small town mayor attempted to dodge capture for flouting lockdown orders by hiding in a coffin and pretending to be a corpse. Jaime Rolando Urbina Torres, the mayor of Tantara, a rural district in Castro Virreina, was out drinking with his friends, just kidding, with his friends, with his friends Monday night when police came to enforce a curfew, sorry, the Evening Standard reported. By the time authorities arrived, though, Torres was lying in an open casket pretending to be a coronavirus fatality with his eyes tightly closed and a mask over his face. His friends hid in drawers in the same room.
Nice photo. Look at that.
No, we got a photo. And so just in case people can't see it, if you're just listening, the guy is lying in a coffin, in an open casket, and has a mask over his face. It looks more like a construction worker mask than anything else. Officers were able to rouse Torres and take the group to the station for questions, so it's unknown if charges were filed. Police later released a photograph of Torres in the coffin. So, I don't know. I think he started out as irresponsible, of course, in terms of his behavior around the lockdown. But maybe he compensated for it with this visual, which really shows the potential lethality of coronavirus.
Right. Although it was messaging, actually. Yeah.
Except, you know what? He undid that because of the mask. He undermined the potential messaging. Although it's mixed because I'm glad he put on the mask.
Well, otherwise it would have been obvious he was breathing. So.
Oh yeah, you're right. If anything, I would reelect him because he's fast on his feet.
I think from now on, they should just start putting live rats or bats in down the pants of people who are
lying
around in coffins just to make sure that they're actually dead.
Or you take off the mask and put it in the mouth, which is, remember that happened to the guy who fell into a hole in the pavement in New York and his brother was saying he couldn't scream. Yeah, because the rats could come into his mouth?
Rats were going into his mouth. That's odd that we've had two references. Well, we created one of them. That's right, yes.
Yeah. You're like, what a coincidence that we've been reading all these rat mouth stories.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
That sounds like a diss that Biden would make. That sounds like a name Biden would call a resistant voter.
Right.
What was the other one? Yeah.
Fat?
Listen, rat mouth. Fat rat mouth. Stony-eyed. What was the pony thing?
The lying dog-faced pony soldier. Yeah.
Lying dog-faced rat-mouthed pony soldier.
Yeah. Maybe we should look for a new kind of product, like a cattle prod type of thing.
Yeah.
That security personnel could carry just in case you might have a politician pretending to be a corpse.
Right.
To evade lockdown procedures. Just make sure. Just check.
Yeah, you have it. Yeah.
Right?
So like a light taser?
Like a heavy taser.
No, because those can kill people. We don't want to do that.
No. I mean like a cattle prod, like something that'll, you know, that will make him leap out of the coffin if he actually do it. You know what I mean?
As long as they have masks on, because if they don't have masks on, you don't want to expose yourself if you're the electrocutor.
Yeah. No, probably not. It would have to be a pretty long implement then. It would have to be a socially distancing cattle prod.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a six-foot cattle prod.
Let's do it.
Or mayor prod, if you will.
Mayor prod, I like that.
Right.
MP prod.
All right, isn't that weird? It's not really a story. It's just more of a general observation. I was looking at a lot of these, looking up weird news, and a lot of them were these sort of inspirational animal stories. You know, and one of them, here's the story. The story is goat who has best friend loses best friend and is uplifted by the presence of other goats, right? That's the story, right?
Okay.
So Dan, if we could see this video, it's a goat with a broken heart finds strength in friendship. Okay. This is the story.
I remember meeting Halbert and Darius when they lived at Melrose. Darius is this beautiful cream-colored Nubian, just like Halbert is. He has really long, soft ears. And they lived in one of the pens, and they would always come to the edge of the fence when people were walking by, and they'd both put their feet up on the fence and look over the gate, and they'd run up and down the length of the fence playing with you. Over time, we started to notice that Darius was developing this really firm growth on his leg. He took him to Cornell, and it wasn't going to be easily fixable. He was starting to lose mobility in his hind end. We tried physical therapy with him. We tried wheelchairs. Sorry, I knew I was gonna cry. And we tried really hard to get him back to a point where he would be with us for a little bit longer. I had to make the decision to let Darius go. We've seen companions die of a broken heart. And I was really worried that that was gonna happen with Halpert. He had started cuddling with Chucky. And then I started to notice the Gilmore girls following Halpert out to the pasture. A little while after that, I started to notice that Aretha Goat would break underneath the gate to come over here to cuddle with Halpert. So now Halpert, who used to just be Halpert and Darius, is now Halpert, Chucky, Lorelai, Rory, Paris, Lane, and Aretha. So it's a very happy ending.
Okay, first of all, why do you want to cancel this person?
Because that's a totally irresponsible. You don't put an animal down because it's not mobile.
Really?
Put it in a what's the thing called? I can't believe I can't remember this word. Wheelbarrow.
Like a wheelbarrow.
What? That's just lazy. It's not like the animal is dying of cancer or dying of some painful disease.
I think it is actually dying of cancer.
Well, that wasn't revealed. Oh, yeah, but you see, the reason she put it down, there was no indication that it was in pain or it didn't want to go on. It sounds like she's just a lazy goat keeper. She's a gatekeeper, too. She's a gatekeeper when it comes to life.
Mm-hmm. Right, she made that decision. All I want to say is I've reached my limit with animal friendship stories. Like, I think in order to get an actual equilibrium journalistically, we got to have, for every one of those, we got to have more of these. Dan, if we could see Komodo dragons eating cute furry deer.
No, I'm not going to look.
I'm like, oh. Now he's like, ouch.
Oh my God, I don't want to hear that noise.
All right, and then if we can go to like 56 seconds is when you start to see the actual denouement here.
I can't look and I can't hear.
It's like six Komodo dragons just tearing that thing to pieces.
What?
There's some
They're
animal
so
friendship
ugly.
For
They're
you.
They're like reptilian sharks. They need to be put down. If only that woman could go and do to them what she did to Darius.
Look at that one. He's so psyched. He's got a big piece.
I'm just looking at Matt's face instead of the video. We have to... No, seriously, though, Dan, we have to... I'm not joking. Like, you got to put in a trigger warning.
I mean, come on. If we're going to have balance in journalism.
I see what you're saying. Right, you're right. I mean, right, we can't go too far in one direction.
Well, no, I mean, actually, if we're going to be real about it, there should be like 5,000 of those for every of like, you know, goat with a broken heart comes back to life, you know? I just can't do the animal friend thing anymore. I mean, like, is it an internet phenomenon? Like, if you've been on the internet for X number of years, like when you've seen, I don't know, 11,500 of them, is that when it happens? It just happened to me, so.
I think the Dodo website is very responsible for that. Although I shouldn't tell you that because now you're going to use your journalism to try to shut them down.
Well, or to create, you know, Odd or something like that to counter it.
Counter Dodo. Oh, Odd right. I see that. That was very fast of you.
All right, so that was the four food groups for this week. A little strange. We're in an odd mood, you know? We're in a new paradigm. This whole like post-election thing, like I don't think we know what to think about anything.
Yeah.
Right now.
Well, really excited to have coming back to the show none other than Thomas Frank, Tom Frank to friends, author of several really important books. Most recently, The People Know, which is the history of anti-populism. Also, one of my favorite books, Listen Liberal, which I think explains Democrats in one. It's probably one of, in my opinion, the best books to understand the Democrats, and also more his book that was much more covered by the media for reasons you can probably understand by the liberal media is What's the Matter with Kansas, which looks at why people vote for Republicans despite their policies, which don't help them and which actually harm them.
All right, so let's talk to Thomas Frank.
Welcome, Thomas. Welcome, Tom. Welcome, T. Frank, back to the show. So excited to have you back on. You wrote a really interesting piece that I think is pretty, would be pretty helpful to the Dems. For the Guardian. And the thesis is basically, yes, Trump is gone, but Trumpism isn't gone. And if the Democrats don't change direction, they will, two things. One is that the Democrats created Trump and Trumpism by kind of shifting right, abandoning the working class, embracing meritocracy.
Well, right? I like the phrase used. They embraced high-minded white-collar rectitude.
Yeah, that was a good, that's really good.
That's a good word, rectitude.
Yeah, it was great.
Whenever you can get rectitude in, that you're always doing well.
High-minded white collar rectitude. Well, that's the very world that good. I live in. That's like a suburban Washington. People are so fucking good. You know, I just in the last couple of years, I've gotten so sick of goodness. You know, and it's funny. I always considered myself a good person, yeah. a nice person who like tried to teach my kids how to be good humans and everything. I'm so sick of goodness. It's you know, it's just like you overdose on it. It's like with Obama, we overdosed on hope, and I'm just like, I've had enough of, you know, those yard signs. We've talked about these before. The yard signs that try to list all the liberal causes. You know, I'm talking about.
I haven't seen those. No.
Oh yeah. Oh come on. What?
Like love you? Over. Like love trumps hate.
Yeah. No. No. That kind of stuff? They list a whole bunch of causes. So it's and they're each one is in a different color, so you can tell them apart. And it says like, no human is illegal. Women's rights are human rights.
And then it's got some new ones. That's a Hillary quote.
Yeah, and then they add lines to it all the time. Oh, science is real, or something like that. And then. And then they add lines to it, like water is life or something like that. So they, and I wrote about it in The People Know, because they never mentioned labor on this sign. They've tried to list every cause, but they never mentioned the sort of essential one. Right. But it's just like that overdose, you know, you're going around the suburban neighborhood. And I used to take pictures of these every time I saw one in front of a McMansion, you know, like a really ostentatious, really garish, you know, house. And it's just like, I'm just so sick of that. Like all the goodness in the world resides in these couple little blocks of Bethesda, Maryland, you know, and it's just, ew.
Well, it also doesn't win over anyone, right? It like doesn't win over
but
anyone.
It's not meant to, Katie.
Us.
That's the thing. Right. It's not politics like you and I think of politics. It's something else. It's politics as, you know, as, it's a little, well, it's a dopamine
signaling.
Hit. It's a, yes, yeah. It's like, I am so awesome and I am so much better than everybody else, but it's also complacency. These are very, very wealthy people with these signs. These are, you know, this is the whole Democratic push. They're going to win over the affluent suburbs, you know?
Right.
And these are very wealthy people who now, in addition to being, by the way, and think about this historically, okay, 100 years ago or more than that, rich people felt a certain amount of guilt and vulnerability for who they were, you know, and they were always afraid that the class war was coming, and they knew that they were ultimately in the wrong in a democracy to try to, you know, marry into a European aristocracy like the Vanderbilts did or whatever the hell it is, you know, whatever the rich people were doing in the 1880s, they knew it was, it rubbed the democratic sensibility the wrong way. It gnawed at their conscience. But these modern day super rich people are like, no, we're not only richer than you, we're better than you.
Right.
There's a conscience. What do you mean? You're the ones, you know, it's you people in the shitty parts of town. You're the ones that have to be, you know, that have to feel bad about yourself. By the way, last time I talked to you guys, I was in Kansas City. And it's a very wealthy part of Kansas City. It's nothing compared to the two coasts anymore. But when I was growing up, it was a very wealthy area. And went for Biden for the first time. It went Democratic for the first time since 1916.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So over 100 years. Yeah. So.
Well, can we talk about this? Because I got in a little bit of trouble after the election talking about the, you know, the shift in who's electorates, who has what electorate now, right? And it feels like the Trump voter, I mean, to me, the class difference is pretty apparent, that the Democrats have become basically the party of the professional class. They're an upscale urban
party. Matt, there's no doubt about that.
But when you say that, though, they throw statistics back at you and they say, okay, well, this is the income level of the person who voted for this party versus the person who voted for that party.
I am here to explain that for you. That is something I've written about before. It was over 10 years ago, and it's been remarkably consistent. So the Democrats, if you look at the income breakdown, they do really well with the very top sort of bracket, and they do really well with the very bottom bracket. That tends to be, you know, people who are very poor or who are unemployed or who are, you know, handicapped or elderly, who don't have a stable source of income. And those tend to be pretty reliable Democratic voters. And then you've got the people at the very top.
Rubin types, yeah.
Yeah, well, the people we're talking about in Bethesda or in Johnson County, Kansas or whatever. And it's working class tends to be people in the middle. But Matt, this is, look, there's also differences by race and by gender, which are becoming more or less severe depending on how you look at it. So the women are trending towards the Democratic Party. And it was, I mean, when Trump won in 2016, it was the white working class that really did it for him. But now you see him making these, by the way, and we should talk about this, you see him making these inroads with other, which I did not think he would be able to do, making inroads with Latinos and black working class people, which is surprising to me, given what an asshole he is, you know.
Yeah, what do you think that's about?
A bunch of different things. I think one of them is certainly his the immigration stance. One of them is the oil thing. So if you remember those Texas counties along the Rio Grande where they're overwhelmingly Latino. Now I've only just I haven't been there. I don't know any people that live there, but I've read news stories about it. These are places that produce a lot of oil and natural gas, or natural gas anyway. And and they were frightened by Biden saying he was going to crack down on fossil fuels or whatever. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Which is to say that people have interests, you know, that are all over the map, and you can just never generalize about people. It astonishes. So I've been saying, to get us back to the article, I've been saying all these years, Trump is a, there's something wrong with him, in my opinion. His, I've never met him. I don't think his brain works right. I don't think I'm going out on a limb here to say that there's something wrong with him. He's not a good politician. He's really bad at the kind of, retail politics that a guy like Biden grew up doing. Trump sucks at it.
But isn't it a strength also? Because doesn't that make him seem like outside of politics as usual?
Yes. But, remember what he was doing in 16? Insulting every group out there.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
What kind of idiot does that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, he could have won a lot of those voters, and instead he's like, calling Mexicans names. Like, what kind of idiot runs for high office and does that? That's so dumb. And
this last election cycle, just, I mean, with COVID, if he had just not said things like, well, it's only killing old people.
Oh my God.
Right.
Yeah.
Like he just gave away a whole constituency. Like if he hadn't done that, if it wasn't for that weakness of his, which is embedded in his personality.
So I've always said, look, the next Trump is not going to make these mistakes. And the next Trump is actually like the one to look out for. That's where the danger lies, is when you get a real politician who has opportunistically just snatched up the Trump agenda, like a Ted Cruz or something like that. And someone like that's going to be hard to stop, And what surprises me is that it's already started with Trump, with Trump himself. I'm astonished at how well he did this year.
So I guess the question is, what happens with the Democratic Party? Are they going to take this result and say, okay, we got the White House back, we're on the right track?
Yeah, like, of course they are.
I mean, is that what it's going to be, or?
Well, they're going to do what they've always done, in my opinion. which is these are people who are, their complacency is it just bowls you over. They really don't think they have to serve any of their constituencies. Now, I'm going to be real happy to be proven wrong. You know, when Joe Biden comes in there and he's another Franklin Roosevelt, or he uses his magical Lyndon Johnson powers, you know, you know, he was in the Senate all those years. You know, he has those right. skills. Right. When he's able to, like, you know, sweet talk Mitch McConnell into getting his agenda passed, then I will be so happy to be proven wrong. But so I wrote this article in The Guardian, okay, about you know, Biden wins, you know, and then in sort of tongue in cheek offering advice to the Democrats to what to do, you know, knowing of course that they will never do anything that I'm suggesting. It's just a sort of a way of framing the argument about Democrats. And what I said was that you know, we should take a cue from in this last year. This has been a year for icon smashing mm-hmm. and tearing down of statues, and the Democrats could use a dose of that. One of the things that I don't know about you. So I've spent a lot of time reading you remember this book. I spent a lot of time reading the sort of history of the Democratic Party, you know, reading all the Democratic Leadership Council magazines back in the 90s. And
oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have a whole collection of them over here. Wow. All of their memoirs. I have like Gary Hart's, you know, I have all this shit. This is what I used to spend my time.
That's gotta be some hard reading.
Well, you know, but you got it. I used to do it with the conservatives too. You know, I have this incredible collection of conservative literature. Like I have Richard Viguerie's magazine. I have,
nice.
I don't know, like 100 copies of it from the '80s. And yeah, it's difficult to stand.
But Republicans
somebody's
got to
do it. But yeah. You know, if you're going to write a history of these people, you got to do it. So my idea is that the Democrats should take a page from this year of iconoclasm and smash their own, you know, heroes, and take their own heroes to task, and, you know, look at their own past and see where they've gone wrong. Now, they're never in a million years going to do it. For right. them, all of this iconoclasm flows only in one direction, and that's, you know, towards somebody else. Right. But they need to look in the mirror and examine their own past as well. And the first thing they're going to discover when they do that is that basically the faction that controls the Democratic Party now, you know, the sort of Clinton faction, the centrist, you know, what's left of the Democratic Leadership Council, these people, they basically set the table for Trumpism. This is what made Trumpism possible. I mean, the idea that the Republican Party, when we were kids, the idea that the Republican Party would go around calling itself a workers' party, that's nuts. That's it's like that would have been contrary to, like, you know, you're on the wrong planet, mister, or you're in the wrong country. And they do it now with total impunity. And they do it with, like, not only with impunity, with success. You know, they get votes this way. I was just talking to a guy from Japan. He comes over every couple of years to see how America is doing. He's, you know, he's very curious about America. And he was saying, well, you know, in Japan, working class people vote for the more left of the party, you know, right. because that's what they do everywhere in the world. That's normal. Here we've been doing this different thing. We've been on this experiment, as I call it, this 30-year experiment, where the Democrats said, no, we don't want to be that party anymore. By the way, and they said this openly. That's all that Democratic Leadership Council literature from the 80s and the Gary Hart memoirs and the, you know, all those books that they put out. I should pull them off the shelf so I could show off. So you guys are actually interested in this crap. The neoliberals, the exciting new trend in politics in 1984.
Wow.
And that's not a critical book, I'm assuming.
Oh, no, no, no. That's like about how awesome they are. Yeah. Reinventing government. This was going to be the manual for the incoming Clinton administration. So do you see it's all about...
This is all like running government like a business kind of a thing?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is Democrats. This is Democrats, mind you. This is not Republicans. This is Democrats. Anyhow, I've got tons of it.
Well, no, it's the foundation, though, of our whole... Because, you know, they've now brought the Bill Kristols and David Frums back into the fold, right? And now the transformation is now kind of complete. Like, it's this is like the latest version of RoboCop that, you know, that's got all the kinks out. You know what I mean? Like, you know, they've gone back to what they wanted to be all along, which is a national security focused sort of arch capitalist, professional class party.
But
right?
this is happening before our eyes. So that, you know, that just so for a reminder to your viewers who tend to be, I think, tend to be younger because younger people understand computers. people like me are like we get our information from books and shit.
Right.
The Democratic Party used to be, when we were kids, was very, very, very closely identified with organized labor. they were joined at the hip. I mean, that's who funded the party. That's who voted for the party. That's what they were all about. And then in the 80s and 90s, the Democratic, you know, the sort of big thinkers of the Democratic Party decided that's not who they wanted to be anymore. They wanted to reach out to different constituencies, and they...
Now, why did they do that, though? Because they'll tell you it was because they got beat so badly in 84.
Yeah, but that's not a good enough reason. I mean, this has been 30 years now. They'll say that, and they'll, but, it, you know, that's actually... They would say this all the time. They'd also say because they got beat in 72 and because they got beat in 80. But in fact, in all of these elections, the guy who got beat, specifically Jimmy Carter, was one of these like New Democrat. He was a proto New Democrat. He was a proto neoliberal. George McGovern, sorry to say, was also one of those. I mean, he's a guy that I really admire, but he was, you know, the only place he won was Massachusetts. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
It was an early experiment in the, you know, turn your backs on organized labor. It was in the middle of this kind of democratic civil war, but labor didn't endorse him. The AFL-CIO didn't endorse McGovern, and McGovern did really well with the highly educated. It was an early sort of taste of where they are today. It was an early sort of, experimental run. And it's odd because McGovern actually was a really good guy.
He wasn't
anti-war, but he wasn't a labor guy. He wasn't like,
yeah, that's right.
You know, I think who had the labor support that time? Was it Muskie?
Something like that. But this was in a period of where there was just this incredible infighting in the Democratic Party. And so he was identified as this candidate of what they called the new politics, even though that wasn't really fair to McGovern. But that's what he was. That's how he was identified.
And acid amnesty and anarchy. That's what they
and abortion, I believe.
Was that but also was, because the more centrist Dems, corporatish Dems, although they weren't called that then,
There weren't many of them yet at the time. Okay. This was all a glimmer in, you know, Bill Clinton's eye back then, or Gary Hart's eye, or however you want to put it. But there was this new generation of Democrats coming up at the time, and they had all these different names for them, the Atari Democrats, the neoliberals. But they were going to identify the party with white collar people, and specifically in like information age professions. You know, the whole idea, they fell in love with the idea of the post-industrial society. And what comes out of this, what's really interesting about this is, you know, there's nothing really wrong with that, with identifying, you know, saying, yeah, look, we're moving in this particular economic direction. The problem is identifying with the winners rather than the working class. You know, that's really strange. And you see that going on right now in California, where they identify, you know, like it was Democrats that got that prop. What was it? Prop 22?
22. Yes.
Yeah. That's Democrats Harris's- did that.
And Kamala Harris's brother-in-law helped do that. And that's an awful, awful thing that really erodes the rights of the people.
But that's they identify with the Silicon Valley companies rather than the people who work for them.
Yeah.
So that's a fundamental shift there. Anyhow, this has been going on for a long time. And it's sort of it's most if you read this party literature that I'm talking about, the most successful sort of exemplar of it was Bill Clinton, the Clinton administration. And you know, when I was writing Listen Liberal, Clinton is a big part of it. And I decided I would read only books that were flattering to Clinton, right, authors that really admired him, people that thought he was great. So none of the conspiracy literature, none of the like Wall Street Journal stuff. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. You remember how they hounded him? Mm-hmm. So I didn't read any of that. I only read books that were favorable to him, books by people who thought Bill Clinton was.
And oddly enough, some of those journal people turned out to be big hatchet folks for Hillary later on, but whatever. Yeah.
Like Glenn but Sisson. You didn't read books by people who thought he murdered
right, Vince Forrest. Foster. Vince yeah, Foster, none of that. Yeah. None of that. None of that. Or that he was a drug runner or any of that. None of that.
So those would have been
entertaining. It was books that admired him. And they would say, what are Clinton's great achievements? And there's five of them. You remember this? So there, what's his great achievements? NAFTA, bank deregulation,
welfare reform.
Welfare reform, the crime bill of 94.
Balancing the budget.
The balanced budget.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All five of these sucked. And when, now that you look back at them, all five of them are disasters. All five of them were Reaganism, by the way. All five of them were inherited from Republicans. Basically, Clinton got the Reagan agenda done when Reagan couldn't do it. And
how much of this was donor driven?
At the time, Republicans were still massively outraising Democrats. Now the tables have turned now, but Clinton is the one who famously, it was under Clinton that Wall Street started to change sides. So again, when Reagan was president, Wall Street was the most Republican constituency in America, you know, big banks, finance, you know. But under Clinton, they started to change sides. And again, this too was like a cause for celebration. You know, there's a whole book about this, about how wonderful this is, that, you know, that Clinton marks the end of the trend that began with William Jennings Bryan. Remember when we talked last time or two times ago, or whenever it was, Bryan is when the Democratic Party shifts to the left, when he gets up there and denounces the gold standard and the banks and all that. That's when the Democratic Party becomes a party that is, you know, like noticeably more to the left than the Republicans. And that lasted up to Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton ends that. He's the end of that. And he reaches out to Wall Street, deregulates these guys at the same time as he cracks down on poor people, you know, with the crime bill of 94, specifically black poor people. And so these two things go hand in hand. You have liberation for finance. By the way, tell me to shut up when you want me to shut up.
No. This is all great. Yeah.
Liberation for finance and discipline for working people. And this is Democrats that did this. I mean, the Republicans tried, but Clinton went much further than the Republicans did. And that began the shift. And so what I say in the article is, like, if you want to understand how it's possible for Donald Trump to win, you know, these working class areas and to win these sort of hard done by cities. And, you know, what are all the sort of the places in Ohio and Pennsylvania that are just ruined and they're voting for a Republican. You know, if you want to understand why that's happening, you have to go back and look at what the Democrats did. And you have to, if you want to do something about it, if you want to stop Trumpism, and we should talk about this in a minute, but if you ask me, Biden's number one agenda item has to be the pandemic, but his number two agenda item has to be stopping Trumpism. This has to stop. If you want to stop it, there's only one way, and that is you have to somehow break his grip on that constituency, that formerly Democratic constituency. And that actually would not be that hard. It really wouldn't.
Okay. Just to interject though quickly, because the response to that, I think the conventional wisdom response to that would be, well, actually, those votes started to shift over to Republicans because of busing, because of LBJ, you know, embracing the Civil Rights Act, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, I don't know about Civil Rights Act. That's the South. That's a different question. That's
sure.
But the South was gone even before that, in my opinion. That's you know, like Goldwater carried the South. Strom Thurmond beat Truman in the South. The South was gone, and if Democrats thought they could hold on to it, they were crazy. But that was the Democratic Leadership Council used to always say this: the Democrats can't win without the South. But that was wrong, because they didn't understand that California would flip eventually. Mm. I mean, sorry, we're getting into the weeds here. The real turning point was the Vietnam War. Busing was big in some places, like you're in Boston, right, Matt?
I was.
Yeah, I mean, that was huge. You know, remember that? What's that great book about the busing?
Well, is it Common Ground?
What's the author? Anthony Lucas, yeah.
So, yeah, that was important, but, you know, And the culture war, you know, and I wrote about this in What's the Matter with Kansas, the culture war issues are hugely important. But and I don't think that Democrats can go back on that. And I don't think that Democrats should bid for the bigot vote. By the way, that's one of the things that that Bill Clinton did. You know, and sure. when you talk about why we need to like cancel, you know, new Democrats, that's what the crime bill was. That's what welfare reform was. That was a bid for the bigot vote.
Ricky Ray, his execution.
That was the centrist faction of the Democratic Party that did that. You know, and now these are the same people that tell you they're all like, you know, they're all woke and shit. But these are the guys that did this.
They're woke in discourse to distract from being unwoke in policy.
Well, to distract from what they actually did 20 years ago, you know.
I mean, and are doing now.
Welfare
right?
reform, that was a monstrous deed. That was cruel. And, you know, that's the only New Deal program that's ever been completely overturned. What's the word? It doesn't exist anymore. It's
dismantled.
Gone. Yeah. And that was Bill Clinton's big bid for the sort of bigot vote. And
I mean, one of the biggest myths that lets that happen, right, is the way that they separate economic issues from racial justice issues as if they're mutually exclusive instead of actually quite related, right?
Yes. But what we're talking about is like, can those people be won back? And I think the answer is obviously yes, because people do ultimately vote their economic interests if there is a real option on the table and it's clear, you know, it's, you know, clearly understood. Everybody knows what the stakes are. And it's especially possible if they're members of a union. You know, there's this weird thing there's this effect that unions have just being a member, you know, getting the newsletter, you know, it changes the way people think about politics. And the obvious thing that you do if you're Biden and you want to stop Trumpism, God, make it easy to join a union again. Let that happen all over America, you know, and don't do shit like Prop 22 in California. Another thing, you know, I think about this all the time. I wrote a story for The Guardian a couple of years ago where I went to Walt Disney's hometown. It's north of Kansas City. It's in Missouri. And it's like all small towns in Missouri. And then I went to the county seat of the county that it's located in. And, you know, it's a disaster. You walk down their main street and everything's boarded up and their local newspaper's gone. And, you know, people are really, really, really struggling in these places. And what's the Democrats' you know, what do the Democrats say to them? You know what they say, because Rahm Emanuel said it just the other day.
He's the worst.
Those jobs aren't coming back, which is, you know, it's like you just lost their vote. Nice going. And B, it's wrong. It's just flat wrong. There's all sorts of things that you can do to make those places, you know, have an economy again. It just, it burns me up that they don't even try. They're so lost in this Silicon Valley fantasy of theirs, you know, this new economy fantasy of theirs, that they can't imagine, you know, the 100 million of the people in the country that they want to rule are suffering. And they're like, there's nothing we can do about that. Like, what kind of politician says that? It just blows those people off.
What are the ulterior motives for them? Like what, how is this in their own self-interest?
They don't want to do anything for those people. Right. They're not interested in that. They're interested in these other things. These are not like particularly brilliant people we're talking about here. You know, they like Obama was a great speaker. I thought he was a brilliant guy, but I don't think these are overall, you know, particularly creative or bold thinkers. They don't really do anything. You know, this is one of the things that's someone who votes for Democrats and is a very liberal person, watching the Republicans in office push the boundaries on everything, you know, Trump shattering right. norms, Trump signing those executive orders, Trump, you know, and look what he's doing right now, you know, pushing the boundaries on the transition. You know, and we'll talk about that later, I'm sure, but they're constantly coming up with some new way of challenging the system. And the Democrats don't do that. They're utterly complacent. And, you know, the thing is that the bottom line is this, it wouldn't be that hard to figure out what you have to do to get the rural economy of this country going again. It's really not that tough. I mean, you smash the agricultural monopolies to begin with, you go after the other monopolies, you know, you know, like in these towns, you know, Walmart's put every main street in Kansas and Missouri out of business. You make them not do that anymore.
Isn't part of your thesis in Listen Liberal that Obama is smart, right? Isn't your thesis
objectively, he's kind of a genius. Yeah.
Not even that, that they are very, this is a very self-interested approach, right? It's not that they need to abandon, you know, like the narrative, of course, is that Republicans don't let them do things, but they don't want to do these things, right?
Exactly. It's not in their worldview, these people are ultimately, you know, to blame for their own fate. You know, these are when the whole shift to the sort of a white collar professional class, this is bigger than just winning elections in fancy suburbs. This is who the Democrats understand. This is how they understand themselves. It's how they understand, you know, the world. And they look at other, you know, white collar professionals and they say, well, these people deserve what they have. They went to good schools.
Right.
They did well. They got, you know, high SAT scores. Grade point average or whatever the hell it is. And they deserve what they have. But these people in, you know, farmers or people in small towns or blue collar workers somewhere, they didn't do those things. They didn't work hard in school. You know, they didn't follow this career trajectory that signifies merit. And so their fate is something that they deserve in a way. And at the same time, you know, this is the other side of the coin when they're going to these, you know, these Wall Street guys that gave us the global financial crisis and refusing to prosecute them because these are great guys. These are the best and the brightest. You don't prosecute those people. You give them another chance.
Don't they also reap material benefits, though? Can you talk about that? Like, it's not just ideology, right? They actually get things out of this.
Well, of course, it's always better to be the party that, you know, identifies with the wealthy than it is to be the party that identifies with labor. You remember, Harry Truman retired as Harry Truman's the last president that didn't go to college. When Harry Truman finished being president, he went back home to Independence, Missouri, which is a suburb of Kansas City. And he didn't have a pension. He didn't have a source of income and he wasn't rich. And, he moved back in with his mother-in-law. And the reporters, you know, followed him and they said to him, so Mr. President, you know, what's the first thing you did when you got home? He's like, well, I carried the suitcases up to the attic. And they did set up a pension for ex-presidents just because of him, because he didn't have a source of income. And he eventually started the Truman Library. It was the first of the presidential libraries. Did I tell you guys about this?
No.
I didn't tell you the story? Well, if you ever come to Kansas City, you got to visit it, you know, when COVID is done. It's the first of the presidential libraries, and it's one story. And I think it cost like, you can look this up on Wikipedia, but I think it cost like $1.5 million, which Truman managed to raise, you know.
Wow,
and
that's a lot.
And it's like, okay, what does the Barack Obama library cost? You know, but that's just, that gives you a taste, an idea of why it's better to be the party of Wall Street than to be the party of, you know, organized of the CIO or something. It's, or look at Bill Clinton's library, which is incredibly extravagant. The Bushes both have fancy libraries.
The Trump library is going to be interesting because it's going to be
I'm
opulent,
looking forward to
but
that
it won't have any books in it.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. Bush's favorite book is Harry the Hungry Caterpillar. That's what he said when asked. So I wonder if he just has a bunch of those copies and then some artwork of his.
But the Clinton library is very heavy on text. It's you know, it's all of this kind of white collar sensibility just in your face. You can look up, they have paper records that you can look up Bill Clinton's whereabouts at every moment, every minute of his time as president. And it fills all of these shelves. You can see where he was. Yeah. Anyhow, they're worth visiting, but they're total, you know, I don't want to change the subject too much here, but they're just propaganda, you know, propaganda edifices that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But
follow up on that, just quickly, I mean, you know, taking the thesis of the people know that, you know, that you wrote, I mean, can't you say that what they just pulled off it's actually pretty impressive. They threaded the needle.
The D's.
They snuffed out the Sanders movement, and they snuck past Trump back into the White House at a moment when there's widespread discontent. Isn't this exactly what their whole business model is designed to pull off?
Yeah, and in some ways it did function perfectly because they got their perfect guy into the White House. I was actually, I thought it was going to be I thought that the Clinton faction was going to choose Harris. I was surprised when they settled on Biden because I thought Biden was old and infirm, or appeared to be anyways. But they did it. They got their guy in, and he's in some ways he's perfect for them. He's a complete continuation of everything I've been describing. This is a guy that ironically was one of the authors of the crime bill of 1994. It's a weird thing to be running that guy for president in the great year of Black Lives Matter. It's kind of a strange move. It's also, but it, ultimately I think they got incredibly lucky this year. If it had not been for COVID, I don't think Biden would have beat him. Trump is an idiot, but Trump had a roaring economy. And ultimately, that's what people vote on. And you take that away, and you've got everybody cooped up indoors in a universal pandemic, and this guy has no clue how to deal with it, and it has trouble showing empathy. And Trump, he lost it, and Biden got extremely lucky. Now but then again, so many elections are decided that way, some last minute thing or some thing in just the last 6 months, it's politics is not a hard and fast thing. And who knows, as I said at the start of the show, maybe Biden will be Franklin Roosevelt. Maybe Biden will get in touch with his inner Lyndon Johnson, and he'll be able to get this amazing progressive program right through Congress, right, sneak it right by Mitch McConnell.
I mean, his inner LBJ and FDR that he's been hiding for 70 years.
But that's the thing, is he does. I've written about this before, too. There are all of these progressives who like him. Do you know about this? There's all of these progressives here in Washington who think he's a really great guy. And exactly what you just said, he's been hiding it all this time.
Oh, right.
And now that he gets to be his own man and fill his own administration, look out, world. Here comes the greatest progressives. Well, Bernie Sanders himself said this.
Bernie likes him.
Be the most
progressive. Yeah, Bernie likes him and wanted to get him elected.
Yeah, they're friends. They're pals.
Terrible. It was a terrible thing for the election, for the primary.
So what happens with populism going forward? I mean, obviously there are some Republicans who, whether it's cynicism or whatever, they at least see the potential in that direction, right? We saw Josh Hawley on the night of the election saying the Republicans' future is as a working class party.
Hey, there's no doubt about that. I mean, look, if the Democrats don't stop them,
right?
Of course they're going to go that way. But the whole genius of being a workers' party is, Trump was only able to win pretty much white working class votes in 16. He did a little better in 2020 with that, with other categories. But a smart right wing populist, a smart guy who's doing this kind of phony populist game, would easily reach out to all these other working class voters. And would probably do pretty well, and it wouldn't take much, it wouldn't take all that much, but if they just don't make Trumpian mistakes. I think that the thing is that Trumpism is dynamic. Trumpism in the right hands is going to be really goddamn hard to stop, and that's what Biden has to be looking at. I guarantee you he's not, though. This is the funny thing. I write these articles and, it's like a heuristic. It's a way of making an argument where I know they're not thinking about this. I know he's not going to pull together a blue ribbon panel to say, what should we do about Trumpism? Of course he's not going to do that.
Right.
They're just going to do what they always do. And
what would have to happen for him to do that?
How about a huge defeat in the midterms? But Look, on the other hand, maybe Biden will deliver a roaring economy and all this will be forgotten. And it'll be like the next Republican will be someone like Bob Dole, you know, and they'll right. just the D's will just roll on and on and on. And we don't have anything to worry about. And anyhow, I'm getting out of this game anyways. I'm not writing about politics anymore. So this is the last, you know, this is my last election.
And, really?
What are you going to do? What are you going to move into?
I've got so many other things to look at all them books, lady. Look at all that, huh?
I'm going to. Yeah. Back to advertising.
All that stuff. Well, that's where research? I start. That's where I started. So.
Yeah. French,
sports.
French stuff.
That's what you got to do.
Sports. That's an idea.
You and I should start a sports magazine. That's an idea.
I can be the co-founder.
So that's really where, I mean, when I was seven. You know, and the Kansas City Royals were good in the 1970s.
Oh, those were
cool.
That
teams. Was like the last time I was really into sports.
Willie Wilson? Yep.
No, it was George Brett. George Brett Hal McRae were there back to back, you know.
Remember his hemorrhoid story?
No.
You don't remember this? I hope I'm not lying about this, but George Brett, Katie, was one of the
Is
great
this why
baseball
he
players.
He couldn't like slide when he was stealing.
No,
or something?
He was going to miss a game in the World Series because of this.
Oh, that's bad.
And he had hemorrhoids, and the reporters were asking him if he was okay. And I'm Dan, you might want to look this up to make sure I'm not lying. But I think his quote was something along the lines of, "No, it's all behind me now."
Wow, that's like a dad.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's like one of the great sports things of all time.
Yeah.
But my pain is all behind me.
That's really funny. That's great. That's great. I hope that was really when it was resolved. Part of your book is your latest book, The People Know, argues that populism is not right wing. And I think that, you know, we see a lot of discourse about right wing populism and people identifying that way. So what is that? Is that a co-opting of it, a hijacking of it? Is that a kind of dishonest appeal to the working class that isn't actually reflected in policy?
I'd say, I was thinking about this today because I was watching
Rising.
You know, TV the last couple of days and I saw the word populism. Well, I just saw an article by Neil Ferguson in the Washington Post where he used the word just in this grotesquely incorrect way that academics often do. And I keep thinking it's like the Pizzagate of the intellectual elite, you know? It's like this myth that they've invented that they all believe and that you can't tell them, you know, differently.
Yeah.
This is what populism is. And a lot of it is just plain wrong. But you know, like the populism was not this, you know, it was not racist demagoguery. That's something else. You know, that's racist demagoguery is what that is, you know? And, I've been on your show and we talked about that in some detail, how the word got flipped and there's a whole myth that is attached to the word now, where the word implies that, working class people are never suitable for democracy. They'll always vote for racist demagogues. And the people that you have to have in charge are, guess who? Yes, that's right. The white collar professional class. They always do everything right for you. And, you know, the elites are great and they run things fantastic and the best and the brightest and the smartest guys in the room. And that's the myth that word basically encompasses. And I'm real proud of The People Know, but I can't make a dent in that usage. I can't do it. But look, I also use the word this kind of, in What's the Matter with Kansas, it was all about fake populism. I mean, there is this sense in which Trump and Reagan before him and George W. Bush and Newt Gingrich and all of these guys were fake populists pretending to care about working people. And most importantly, pretending to hate the elite. I mean, Reagan, right? He talked about this all the time. Nixon, Pat Buchanan, they all talked about this, how much they hated the elite. And what did they mean by the elite? Well, they meant like TV anchorman, you know, they meant, you know, the news media and stuff like
Sean
that.
Penn.
Yeah, stuff like Hollywood, you know? Yeah, they hated the elite. But at the same time, these guys were the, you know, doing the bidding of the Koch brothers and,
right.
you know,
Even
Wall Street.
It's funny that Pat Buchanan would always appear on the McLaughlin Group.
Yeah. Yeah, but he had this kind of, you know, sort of proto-Trump, you know, Trump steals a whole lot of his message and his mannerisms and everything from Pat Buchanan. But if you remember that TV show, Buchanan always was the guy that had the sort of gruff, you know, sort of, I mean, sort of Trumpism before Trump. The way that he talked was kind of vulgar and like talked like a tough guy and this kind of thing. And it's an act. It's a kind of workerist act that these people did and do. I mean, it's not a coincidence that Ronald Reagan is the only union president that's ever been elected president of the United States, the Screen Actors Guild. But, you know, Reagan knew that language. Reagan knew how to fake it, that 1930s language, that Frank Capra stuff. And he did a great job faking it.
But isn't this incarnation of Republicans in the Trump era, though? Aren't they? It feels to me like they're a little bit more willing to go in the direction of. So Buchanan was his big concrete nod to populism was protectionism.
Right.
But the pops weren't protectionists. This is the thing that it's like, you can argue about that. But so this is like just in this news. I saw a newspaper article in the Post the other day where it said, you know, all populists are protectionists. And then a guy was listing populists and he doesn't list any actual populists, but he does list William Jennings Bryan. Well, dude, William Jennings Bryan was a huge free trader. All farmers are. Farmers are always free traders. It's like, how can the Post, and it's like, where's the fact checker? Where's the fucking Pinocchios for this article? You know, it's like they can say anything they want about history.
Maybe it's not populism.
You're onto something there because you can make the argument that NAFTA and these other things are not really free trade. NAFTA is, if you ever look into it, NAFTA is 2,000 pages long. If you were going to say that tariffs between the U.S. and Mexico are now zero, you can do that in a single paragraph. NAFTA is 2,000 pages long because it protects all of this American investment in Mexico, and it protects Big Pharma, and it protects Hollywood, it protects intellectual property rights, and it sets up these tribunals to make sure that the Mexican government, and in fact the U.S. government, can't regulate businesses. It's a supranational thing. That's not free trade. That's something else. And I am perfectly comfortable being a populist and saying that NAFTA sucks, NAFTA is a disaster. Those two things are fine. They go together perfectly well in my mind. So yeah, there's contradictions all over the place. What did Nietzsche say? I contradict myself. Big deal.
But labels aside, right? And classification aside, what is protectionism combined with bigotry or Holocaust denial, low key Holocaust denial in the case of Pat Buchanan? Is that
fascism?
I
don't know about free trade. I mean, I don't know where fascists stood on trade. I mean, I have no idea actually. But
Buchanan's anti-NAFTA, right? I'm not defending
Buchanan was the proto-Trump. He was the first one to force that issue into the – or was it Ross Perot? I think it was Perot, actually. So Perot was going after NAFTA right when it happened. So that was 90 – was it 92? And then he had that famous debate with Al Gore, I think, in 93 or 94, right when they passed NAFTA. And Gore taunted him as being a protectionist. This debate is so dishonest in so many ways. But it's funny because Ross Perot turned out to be almost exactly right about NAFTA. And Buchanan is just an opportunist he had a good issue, you know. You remember what Buchanan's slogan was when he ran in, what was it, 96?
I can't remember.
What?
America first.
Something German.
Right. America first. Trump stole his slogan. And Trump stole everything from this guy. And, Buchanan, by the way, is very happy with the results last week. He thinks the R's are perfectly positioned to continue. Well, it's his party now. They basically completely come around to his. You know, you go look back and look at his speech at their convention in '92, where he's talking about the culture war,
right?
And then his stuff in '96. They've come around completely to Buchananism, except for the Holocaust denial stuff.
Right. Can you be popular? I mean, the big thing, I guess the big contradiction, right, is that, and the big dishonesty is that how much can you be a populist or even a protectionist if you don't support labor movements?
Yeah.
And labor unions.
And so, by the way, Buchanan calls himself a populist. He's one of these guys that embraces that term. He doesn't have any right to call himself that, but he does it anyway because he knows that it has a noble history and the word sounds good and that kind of thing. And
it's anti-elite.
There was a time in the 60s and 70s when it had there was a kind of revival of it and people thought it was a good thing. Populism was a good thing and you wanted to be on board with it. Did I ever show you guys this one? No, because last time I talked to you, I was in KC. This is one of the last left-wing politicians to call himself a populist. You see that? It's Fred Harris.
Who's
he? A senator from Oklahoma who ran for president in 76 on this proto-Bernie Sanders platform. And his whole idea was to run on very, very, very small campaign donations. So his supporters held bake sales. And nice. He went around the country in a Winnebago. He did all, and he would stay in people's houses and sleep on their couch and stuff. And there's these hilarious, if you go back and do the research, these hilarious like photos of him in 76 making his campaign phone calls from a gas station, from the payphone at the gas station. He's got a roll of dimes or whatever. But yeah, really great guy. I interviewed him for the book. He's still around.
So. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's just the last question for me is Buchanan's probably, the reason he's probably happy is because the way forward for Republicans, I'm sure what they're thinking is just keep kind of the Trumpian formula and add a thing or two, like an infrastructure employment program that, you know, it doesn't have to be big. They can just...
Well, the most important thing is what they have to subtract. They have to stop being racist.
Right. Yes. Well, that too. Yes.
Overtly. You know, at least overtly.
Yeah, if they stop doing that and they, you know, and look, Trump, I think he vaguely understood that he had rubbed people the wrong way, you know, but he had no, his heart wasn't in it. Like, you know, like he could have really dinged Biden for the 94 crime bill. I mean, he really could have hurt him. And he doesn't need... He didn't know how to do it. He has, his heart isn't in it. He was just, he brought it up at the debate. Remember, I had a bet with you guys. Yeah. He brought it up at the debate and it was just like, he was just saying words. It didn't mean anything. He hadn't embraced it. He hadn't thought about it. He hadn't thought it through. And like a real politician could have really, really parked that, you know, really driven that home. And made and punished Biden for that. That would have been, you know.
He condemned Biden in the same sentence as we both predicted this. But he condemned Biden for being not tough on, not law and order-ish enough.
Yes, he did both in the
sentence.
Same.
Yeah. But I think that that's actually a tip. Like
that was
is
the bet.
Trump,
that's what the bet was. Yeah.
That's Trumpism at its best in a way, because he doesn't have to have any ideology. He just points out. He's an opportunist who points out inconsistencies in others, and it doesn't even matter. The ideology of it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, that's right. He doesn't really even have an ideology. Yeah. Again, just an opportunist, just a guy who likes to see his face on TV.
Yeah.
When you guys, I wonder what you guys think if you're like you're going to be looking back on this 20 years from now. Which one was the more important president? Was it Obama or was it Trump? I mean,
that's a tough
seriously.
Call.
Yeah. I mean, Obama was obviously better at the job, you know, it was elected by, you know, non-controversial, you know, majorities.
But I mean, Trump, the proof of concept that you can get elected doing what Trump did was so far beyond anything that had ever happened before that it's going to open the door for all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think
probably,
so too.
You know what I mean? So yep. I don't know. It's
and I always think of Obama's great lost opportunity, you know, not to be a Trump, but to be a kind of, you know, to be an FDR, you know, which he had in his hands in 2009, you know, when he's going up against the Wall Street banks and the world is behind him. You know, at the time, everybody loved this guy, could have had whatever he wanted. And instead, he used his, you know, his gifts, his real powers to rescue the norms.
Right.
And that's the Democratic Party, you know, and that's the tragedy of Barack Obama and the tragedy of the Democrats, too. Although with Biden, I mean, who the hell knows? Wouldn't it be funny if Biden actually cared about this stuff?
He wouldn't be Biden.
Yeah, that's right. He wouldn't be president today.
Well, so what do you just quickly, what do you think? What do you think is going to be their major policy priority, or are they
just going to spend the next 40? He's already said it's got to be COVID. And then they have a whole list of other things that they're going to do. But I'm not holding my breath. You know, I don't think they're, you know, it doesn't look like the Democrats, unless there's a miracle in Georgia, it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to get the Senate. And that's going to
make perfect for them.
Yeah,
way, so
then,
right?
Then they don't have. Yeah. Remember, we're going to go right back to 2014. Remember, Matt? Mm-hmm. Green Lanternism. That's Green Lanternism. You think that the president can just do things? He's not magical, you know.
So exactly.
It'll be time for me to dust off all those essays that I wrote back then about all the things Obama could do without Congress. But it's sad to start your presidency that way with Biden. That's, you know. That stinks because he's not a strong leader, and he's starting with a weak hand to begin with, without a real mandate. That sucks. Unless the economy really takes off, the Republicans are going to come right back at him in the midterm. So I'm not hugely optimistic. I'm just not hugely optimistic. But, you know, it would be nice if that article that I wrote in The Guardian at least sparked some kind of pushback or some kind of historical reevaluation, let's put it that way, of the days of the neoliberals and the Democratic Leadership Council and the New Democrats and all that high-minded bullshit from the 1990s that has really led us into this terrible impasse. If only the Democrats would even acknowledge that it's led us into this impasse. But no, for them, it's still that's the golden age, right? Clintonism, that's the golden age when we were deregulating banks and telecoms and putting people in jail. That's the golden age.
Right.
So hey, the happy note is at least the imbecile is out of there. Yeah, at least the asshole has to go down to Mar-a-Lago and start his TV show.
Right.
Yes, which we don't have to watch. We won't be required.
Oh, wait.
To watch
which Trump family member do you think is gonna run in 2024? We should play another drinking game about this.
Ooh.
I mean, it's too early, but will it be Trump himself? Will it be Ivanka? Will it
Donald?
Be,
I think Donald Jr.
Don Jr. You think it'll be?
I think it's Trump himself.
Don't you? He'll be 78 though.
Yeah.
So Biden's 78, isn't he?
Or 77,
something. Is he?
Yeah.
I mean, Trump is remarkably vigorous for his age and having COVID.
He's no Bernie though. He's no Bernie. He leans hard onto the podium. It's very funny. Yeah.
He may have been like physiologically already dead for decades.
That's
right?
Why he survived the COVID. And,
right. Yeah, no exactly. So
you know what I've been doing lately to pass the time? I watched both Nosferatu movies, the one from the 20s and the one from 1979.
Wow.
And then I love the Werner
the
Willem
Herzog
Dafoe one with Klaus Kinski. Yes. Oh my god, it is so
that's
good.
It's really funny. We brought him up.
I went and got the novel, the Bram Stoker novel, and now I'm reading that. It's not anywhere near as the Werner Herzog version is the best by far.
Who do you think looks more like Nosferatu, Joe Biden or Rudy Giuliani?
Oh, come on. That's totally Rudy. Rudy is like, it's kind of alarming.
Biden. We have a debate about this. It was Matt who first called. Matt overuses it though. But,
but,
maybe
but
right.
Look at that. Look at the Klaus Kinski version with the ears.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. He is so brilliant. So Klaus Kinski is like, he's my absolute favorite actor of all time. I just think this guy is so awesome.
Yeah. But
yeah. He's so great as the vampire. And it's also a brilliant movie.
Well, on that happy note, Tom, thanks so much. Everybody should check out your Guardian piece and
all your books. And, the People Know.
The People Know.
Yeah.
The People Know is the one that I just like. These days, every time I open the newspaper and see the word populism abused, it just burns me up. And it'll burn you up too. You can be as angry as me.
That's right.
If you buy The People Know.
You can irritate Tom Frank just by going outside right now and misusing that term.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Excellent. No, we'll try not to do that. Yeah. All right, Tom. Thanks a lot for coming by, and we'll check in with you again soon.
All right. See you guys later.
Bye.
That was good.
Yeah, that was good. It was great.
It was great. I mean, look, he's all the stuff that he writes about that, of course, nobody wants to listen to anymore. Right. is so pertinent to what's happening and what's going to happen in the next 4 years. But to me, the most likely scenario is that both parties ignore the advice, and that you and neither party decides to try to become a working like a workers' party, and you end up with just two totally full of shit organizations, one of which is
they are currently.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
They just double down on it. They become even fuller of shit. They become bloated with shit.
Right. Right. But without even the pretense of being.
Right. Maybe the People's Party rises.
Maybe. Like Nosferatu.
Yeah.
And exactly. On that note.
And on that note, yeah.
Excellent. All right. Excellent. Well, rate and review.
Rate and review. Yes. Rate and review on iTunes. Subscribe on YouTube. Hit that subscribe and then that bell.
Smash
the like button and share it with your loved ones and tell them that if it's a battle for the soul of America between us and Pod Save America, which is ironically named, if we're being honest.
That's right. So do all those things, and then we'll see you again next week.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.